Yes, so I was saying that the ideas that are conceived by philosophers and scientists percolate through society and become part of popular culture. So if you talk to the average man on the street and say, "Have you been reading postmodern philosophy?" They will look at you with mystification. "No, I only watch football results on TV and check out the sun. What are you talking about, postmodernism?" But the ideas percolate culture. For example, Darwin's theory of evolution has influenced the way we think about psychology. They call it sociobiology. That our behavior is the result of the beast within that comes from our animal ancestry. So it's a complex idea. I've been reading sociobiology, but it percolates through into popular music. So the Bloodhound Gang, with probably the worst chat-up line I've ever heard, sing, "You and me, baby, are nothing but mammals. Let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel." If you have a first date, I don't suggest you try that as a chat-up line. But the ideas percolate through. So what we're going to do is go to the source of many of the ideas in modern culture and see how they affect society. But we're also going to reflect on what we believe, because we have what they call a meta-narrative. Does anybody know what a meta-narrative is? No idea. It's a coherent story about reality. So what do we believe? We believe that God created Adam and Eve, man and woman, placed them in a garden. They rebelled against God. As a result of that rebellion, there was a fall. We believe that Christ came to redeem the world, rose again from the dead, so he could begin a new creation in the midst of the old. That when we connect to Christ, we're new people. And God's purpose is to rejuvenate the whole universe and place everything under the headship of Christ. So we're part of that purpose. Meaning in life for us is to live for God. Our purpose has been subsumed into God's purpose. So our purpose is to fit into his purpose for our lives, and his purpose is to transform the whole universe. That's what we believe. That's a meta-narrative. And meta-narratives are very unpopular today, but that's what we believe. But we're going to show the relevance of our story. So you've got to follow me. So if you think this is over-intellectual, you are wrong. Because the ideas infiltrate every part of our society. One of the things I've discovered in evangelism is if I connect to people and understand the way that they think and apply the message, far more people respond. And they respond genuinely. They become disciples of Jesus because I've spoken into their world. Paul did that. When he was speaking to Jews in the synagogue, he understood the rabbinical and Jewish mindset. So he used language that they could understand. But when he was in Athens, what did he do? He spoke Greek. I'm sure he did, yes. He went there, yes, that's true. But how did he approach communication? He made it relevant to their world. And then he referred to their own literature. So he spoke from their literature, not from biblical literature, and explained the good news in a way that they can understand. So that's what we're going to be doing during this time. This is the relevance of the talk, because we'll understand how people think out there. In my experience with the church, often the church becomes so involved in the biblical world, they become a subculture. So we all believe the same things. We all understand the same worldview. And we disconnect from how people think out there. And sometimes we deliberately disconnect because the world out there seems a nasty place, whereas the church is a far more comforting and secure environment. In fact, I call it rabbit hole Christianity. We love being in our lovely, warm, affirming rabbit hole. But outside the rabbit hole, there are dangerous predators. There are foxes, wolf packs, stoats, weasels, bears, even lions. So we isolate ourselves from the world. We don't want to think about these things because they're too disturbing. And we cut off. And that makes us irrelevant to society because we have the best message of all. But if it's locked away in a ghetto and only understood in terms that we understand, we never communicate with people. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing relates to my daughter. Now, I've got two daughters. One became a doctor and then decided to transfer from healing of the body to healing of the soul and became an Anglican vicar. The other one was far more unpredictable. Academically, she was brilliant. So high IQ, top in everything without even working. But she was totally original and unpredictable. So I thought she was going to end up in fashion, running her own company, making a lot of money, because she was into image and so on. But she had an encounter with God and became a lot more altruistic. She decided to go to theological college. Now, she didn't have any theological qualifications. She had excellent qualifications, but not in theology. So she talked herself onto the course. And one of the first sessions she went to was called Patristic Theology. I know it's a big name. If I said, I'm going to talk to you this morning about second century patristic theology, you would think, why have they invited that idiot to speak to us this morning? Patristic theology is the theology, the biblical ideas of the early church fathers of the church. So you have the apostles who gave us scripture, but the church fathers are the people who came after them, people like Cyprian and Irenaeus, Ignatius, Cyril of Jerusalem, and so on. All these unusual and exotic characters. So she sat down, and the fellow who was giving the lecture was young and brilliant. He'd recently done his PhD. He knew his topic. And he spoke to the students for an hour with undoubted enthusiasm. My daughter didn't understand a word he said. So she went up to him afterwards and shook him enthusiastically by the hand. It was a big setup. And she said, Malcolm, you're a very clever man. My daughter's attractive, and being told that you're clever by an attractive woman, if you're male and heterosexual, is a compliment. He began to shine. She said, and you're so knowledgeable and intelligent. And she then went on to say, and you really do have a wonderful technical grasp of this topic. And by that time, he was almost radiant with pride. He was almost jumping. This attractive, intelligent young woman was flattering him. And then she said to him, and this was the punchline, "But no one understands a word that you say." That is typical Hannah. That's one of the reasons why I love my daughter. She's always amusing. You wonder what she's going to get up to next. But it did the job. Now, if I talk this morning and you don't understand what I'm talking about, please don't sit there thinking, "It's so profound. I don't understand a word, but I'm not going to say anything in case people think I'm ignorant." Isn't that true? A lot of people don't ask questions because they think if I ask a question, then people will think I'm dumb. My daughter got the first in theology and she only studied for half the course. But she went up and said, "I don't understand a word you're saying." Because if you don't understand and you don't acknowledge a fact, you never learn. Sometimes I have to.
And ask what patristic.
Patristic, patra, its father. That's the Latin word, patra. It's a father of the church. So if you hear patristic theology, it means the fathers, the founding fathers of the church after the apostles. And there are the early church fathers who came from the first centuries, and then there are the latter church fathers who were responsible for the latter period, who formulated Christian theology. Because people didn't work out a doctrine like the Trinity straight away. It was there in Scripture, but they had all sorts of fights, discussions, debates, different views on the topic before the doctrine of the Trinity we have today emerged. And even today, there are theologians who debate it. With the teaching about the true nature of Christ, was he merely a man? Was he God and man? Was his divine nature and his human nature separate, or did they commingle? Did he only become Christ at the baptism? All these views were there. And all these clever thinkers were arguing with each other. And the people that were arguing with each other were the church fathers, because they had to work all this stuff out for themselves. And then they put it into coherent creeds so people understood what Christian truth was, what Orthodox truth was. Has that answered the question? So if you don't understand what I'm talking about, please say, just put your hand up. If you don't understand a word, and sometimes I get carried away and I use words that I shouldn't do. So if I say a word that you don't understand, it's more ignorant to be silent than to ask me what it means. So I'm going to visually illustrate this talk. I think I'll leave it at that. I've got a few more bricks. Now, who can tell me what our idea of evil is? Where does it come from? Original sin. What's original sin? So we're born with sin. Okay. That's an interesting answer. I agree with it. That's true. In sin, my mother conceived me. Psalm 51. The fall of Lucifer. So there's a superhuman aspect to evil. So as a Christian, you believe in what they call a personal devil, not a force of evil. Okay. The problem with the word sin is that it's vague, nebulous. Nebulous means vague. So what is sin? So we say that we're conceived in sin. What, in fact, are we talking about? It's a very good description. In essence, however, sin is independence from God. It's saying yes to me and no to God. So with the interesting narrative in Genesis chapter 1 through 3, we have the description of God creating the heaven and the earth. He creates man and woman in his image. Then he places in the garden a tree of the knowledge of good and evil and says, if you eat of that tree, you will die. So there was a prohibition. It could have been, if you cross this brook, you will die. But we have a tree. And what happens is human beings disobey God. It's a deliberate act of disobedience, and there's a rift. So they choose me over God, and that's the essence of sin. So there's a rift between God and human beings. Now, often we are very spiritual or too spiritual in our thinking. We come to the conclusion that sin is only that rift between God and us. But the interesting thing is that belief in God was foundational to the healthy functioning of every part of life. And when human beings fell, it affected everything. So when we talk of living in a fallen world, it's not merely a world that is estranged from God, but that rift, that crack, goes right through society. Now, I use this in illustration. If I take the foundation away, the whole edifice will collapse. Now, is there anyone clever enough here to remove the three bricks at the bottom without the whole building collapsing? Does anybody have that skill? It's impossible. So what happens when you remove the foundation? Everything collapses. The interesting thing about the fall, which all of us need to understand, is that when we fell, it affected everything. It affected us spiritually, so there's estrangement from God. So the Bible says, when you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die. Death there is not merely physical dissolution. It is spiritual death. We die to God. We are dead, according to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1, in trespasses and in sins. So theoretically, we can conclude that there is a God, but we lose the direct experience of him. Death is being cut off from life. Spiritual death is being cut off from God. So the fact that people don't instinctively relate to God is a result of sin. I was speaking in a school, and I was speaking on this topic, and I said, you're zombies. There are about 500 young people in the assembly hall, and you could see the teachers nodding in affirmation. And I said, you're biologically alive. But as far as God is concerned, you're dead. They liked the idea. I was walking along the corridor in the same school, and a 13-year-old went up to the head teacher and said, you're a zombie, sir. He got a detention on the spot. The head teacher didn't wait for an explanation. So we're separated from God. Two, we are separated from ourselves. We're made in the image and the likeness of God. But the rift with God means that we have an identity crisis. We don't know who we are. And that has been one of the characteristics of the human race for a long time. There are all sorts of explanations of human character and human behavior. In our own society, there are so many of them. We are cut off from ourselves. B, because we don't recognize ourselves as being made in God's image and likeness. Three, there's sexual alienation. God made them male and female. Sexual identity is binary if we stand on the word of God. And for me, it makes eminent sense. It's rational because our genitalia matches. So to create a rift between our sex and gender is an absurdity. It's illogical. Because we were created male and female. But what is happening today? We're cut off from God. And we can choose anyone, according to some authorities, of 87 different types of gender. For me, it's confusing. What? How can there be 87 types of gender? In fact, there are other groups that believe that there are even more. So there's confusion about sexuality. I'm not a supporter of Trump, but I like the idea that he is reintroducing the whole idea that there's male and female. That's one thing that I do agree with. And I hope our politicians listen to him. Because when you make gender a matter of choice, you confuse a lot of people. I make no apology for saying that. There's also matrimonial problems, problems between male and female. So after the fall, what did God say? He said to the woman, your desire will be towards your husband, but you will rule over him. He will rule over you. And that means he will dominate you. I'm sympathetic with many of the arguments of feminists, because if you study history, women have been oppressed. It seems remarkable that it was only early in the 20th century that women were allowed to vote. Eugenics in the 19th century argued that women had smaller brains than men and they were less intelligent. All the evidence today shows that that is totally erroneous. They said women were governed by emotions, men by rationality. That's another fib. Why is it that girls are excelling in education and doing better than men today? It was men who defined the role of women. They ruled over women. And the history of our world is one of the constant oppression of women. There's no doubt about that. I'm not on a bandwagon here. I'm just giving you the facts of history. In every culture, apart from one or two rare cultures, women have always been dominated, and that is a result of the fall. And what God does is to restore male-female relations. I always find it interesting that men, when they're talking about the role of women, stress the fact that wives should be submissive to their husbands. The word is supertasso. It doesn't mean a wrestling hold, which is so tight the person has to submit. It doesn't mean obedience. It means giving preference to. Not fighting against your husband. But it's followed up by husbands of wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. So the whole idea of the husband's role is to lay down his life for his wife. So the wife is not married so she can give birth to his children, darn his socks, wash his clothes, prepare his meals, correct his correspondence, are merely pushing forward and supporting. No, no, no. If a husband loves his wife as Christ loved the church, what does he do? He puts his wife's feelings and her development before his own. No, it's fifthly, society disintegrates. What happened immediately after the fall in Adam and Eve's family? Cain slew Abel. And if we look at those early chapters of Genesis, that kind of conflict continued until the Tower of Babel, when everything fragmented. So the problems in our society at root come from the fact that we are alienated from God, that we no longer connect to one another. And finally, and this is very relevant, climate control. Human beings became alienated from creation. So the role of human beings, according to Genesis, was to have dominion. That doesn't mean exploiting the earth's resources. It means stewardship and care. So in the Garden of Eden, they tended the garden. They looked after it. Their monarchy was not one of oppression, but facilitation. In other words, they were caring for what God had given them. They weren't raping the earth and exploiting its resources. They were concerned for the animal creation and creation itself. So what is happening today? Our greed is destroying the planet. It's as simple as that. And this is not speculative or ideological. Since the 1960s, when I first became aware of this, I read a book called By the Treaty of Rome, talking about how the world was running out of its natural resources. The predictions were already there that our kind of consumerism and greed and economics would slowly destroy the integrity of our planet. And that is happening today. We of all people should be concerned about ecology, because God has shown us our true destiny to have stewardship and care of his creation. So for those of us who are Christians, we believe that the rift has affected every part of life. Are you with me? So when we look at the world, with its conflicts, its complexities, its power struggles, its genocide, its selfishness and greed, we see a rift going right through it. We're dysfunctional because we are no longer in relationship with God. That's what we see. And that is a view that we take into the world. Now, what does the world think? Ever since Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire under Constantine, and suddenly bishops were no longer the persecuted leaders of the church, but dignitaries of the empire. You can see that in the architecture of the church. The bishop sits on a throne, he becomes a royal official. Ever since Christianity became the religion of the empire, the biblical narrative was dominant. So if you talk to a serf in medieval Cirencester and says to him, "Where does evil come from?" he would tell you the story of Adam and Eve. Because everyone knew that story. And if anyone deviated from the story and said, "We don't believe that," they could be imprisoned or burnt alive by the Inquisition, tortured until they acknowledged Christian truth. So the Christian message was maintained by the authority, not only of the church, but the state. So everybody believed the same thing. We believed in the reality of sin. We believed in the reality of the devil. We believed in the meta-narrative, the story of the gospel. But there was a movement in society which began, I think, in the Renaissance, when knowledge became detached from theology. So before that time, the big topic taught in all our universities was theology. Not sociology, not science, not literature, but theology. They called it the queen of the sciences. So study of the Bible was the main preoccupation of Western scholars. And some of them were brilliant. I've read Aquinas, I've read many of them. And they're undoubtedly brilliant men, but they are thinking theologically. But with the Renaissance, people began to study for learning itself. So they went back to the Greeks, they went back to their philosophers, they went back to Plato, Aristotle, they went back to Pythagoras, they went back to all these thinkers, and knowledge was separated from theology. Now that was the first trend, but if you talk to Michelangelo or Leonardo or Donatella or any of the other people, they would still believe in the creation story. Even Galileo, who was nearly burnt alive, his views, believed in the creation story. So it was common knowledge. But in the 17th century, there was a movement called the Enlightenment. And it was a movement that worshipped rationality. A lot of the thinkers that emerged either were atheistic or else they were deists. Now, I'll tell you what deist means. Now, what the deists believed was that God was a great clock maker, that the universe itself was a clock. And God had created all the cogs and mechanisms of the clock, and all of them worked according to immutable laws. So they couldn't be changed. God started the clock ticking, and then he withdrew. So he no longer interfered with the clock. He let it tick away, ring its alarms. He let its pendulum swing, but he wouldn't intervene. The thinkers of that period argued that there's no intervention. They questioned events like the incarnation and the resurrection. They said they're mythological. They didn't believe in miracles. Even if they believed in God, God was outside the clock. Are you following me? Now, this had profound implications. There was one very prominent thinker. I quite like this man. He was eccentric and crazy. His name was Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And he thought about human beings, and he came to the conclusion that human beings were perfect at birth. So no original sin. And he argued that evil was a contamination of a greedy culture. So we weren't responsible for sin. It was culture that had imprinted evil on us. Yes, he argued that. He didn't believe that we were born in sin. He believed that we were born perfect. And he also had a very idealistic, in fact, I think naive view of the world. He said, primitive agricultural cultures, like people in the Garden of Eden, they're uncontaminated by evil. But when civilization comes with its greed, its capitalism, its selfishness, that contaminates the human being. That's what he said. Now, that's a ludicrous idea because we know from anthropology that human beings have always been savage. So this idea of the noble savage, which was very popular, even people like Wordsworth, the poet, had this idea of human nature, that if you get people back into an agricultural lifestyle, they will revert to their original innocence. That idea has been disproved not only by human experience, but by anthropology. So that was one view. Another view, which was very similar, and this is incredibly influential even today, was put across by John Locke. And it was tabula rasa. That's Latin. And it means the blank slate. Now, what he argued was that people were born neutral. It was a similar idea. And society stamped its image on them. Now, I like John Locke because when he was writing, we lived in a class society, there were huge divisions. And people believed that their position in society, if they were aristocrats and wealthy, was because they were destined for that. So they didn't believe that the world was equal. They believed that the world was unequal. That there were those that were powerful, wealthy, aristocratic, who owned vast estates. Their privilege was predetermined because people are not equal. But the poor, who lived on a sparse diet, died young, who lived in poverty, that was their position. So Locke said, no, that's not the case. He said, everybody is born equal. It's society that shapes who we are. And he said, if you give a poor man education, he will rise as high as a rich man. That was his argument. But the whole idea of the blank state that society influences people is very important. So they saw people like this. A blank board. So when a person is born, he didn't know anything about genetics. He didn't believe that there were any inbuilt tendencies or drives. Human beings were born like this. But they were defined by the society and culture in which they lived. So no original sin, neutrality. So everything moved away from human responsibility to society. So even the American Bill of Independence was based on this thinking. It was Enlightenment thinking that we are born equal. Now this has filtered down into the modern world. So if you believe that there's no such thing as original sin, you look for other reason for evil, don't you? And some of them were bizarre. Henry Goddard, who was a proponent of eugenics, studied a family called the Kallikaks. Some of them were high performers. Others he described, in quotes, as feeble-minded. That was his word, not mine. It meant that they were, we would call them special needs or educationally challenged. He made a ridiculous assumption. He associated feeble-mindedness with criminality and sin. And he advocated the sterilization of anyone who was defined as feeble-minded. Now, do you find that preposterous? Let me tell you that in the early 20th century, right up until the 40s, over 30 states in America adopted his view. And it was institutionalized. Over 62,000 people in America were sterilized because of feeble-mindedness. Now, when you think about that logically, it's absurd. Mendeley, the doctor at Auschwitz, a man of almost uncanny evil, was brilliant. Some of the worst psychopaths in history have been brilliant. Genghis Khan, the great conqueror, probably the most brilliant general in history, was guilty of genocide. He would wipe out cities, wipe out children, wipe out women, wipe out every living thing, exterminate them all. It was brilliant. So this idea that wickedness is associated with low intellectual ability, a low IQ, is ridiculous. But in the state of mind, when you're looking for other reasons for evil, I suppose for some people it becomes a probability. That's the difficulty. How much time have I got? In that case, no, for 5 minutes, let me go on for another five. So then we come to Charles Darwin. Now, the theory of evolution is a theory, it's a construct. And I think what people don't recognize is that every scientific view is a model. It's a model that's created and then it's assessed statistically to see if it works. So we take models as facts, but they're not. They're far more flexible than that. So with Darwin's theory of evolution, he came up with the idea of natural selection, that what drives human evolution is the struggle to survive. And the fittest, the strongest, and the most intelligent are the ones that survive. So it's a logical viewpoint. But he knew nothing about genetics. But people accepted that model of reality. I read The Origin of Species years ago and found it a very intriguing book. It was speculative. The ideas were interesting. I didn't agree with it. But the argument was elaborate and intelligent. I don't doubt that. The problem is that when you begin to think of human beings as animals, it is logical to assume that the wickedness of the human race comes from our bestial past. So each one of us is like the Incredible Hulk. I'm not really a fan of Marvel comic movies. I never take them seriously. I like Lord of the Rings in that genre of fantasy, but Batman, Superman, the Incredible Hulk, Wolverine, they're not things that I watch. But I have seen at least one Incredible Hulk movie. So you get this very suave, sensible man who's a doctor of all things. He studied medicine. But in certain circumstances, what happens? He transforms into the beast. Even his complexion changes. The Caucasian turns green. It's a horrific transformation. The beast is unleashed. Now, that's what people think about evil. So the genocide, the lust, the desire to dominate, all the evil of the human race, the wars, are a result of our bestial past. But let me ask you, have you ever seen a pride of lions practicing genocide? Have you ever seen a giraffe attacking creation and creating a climate disaster? Have you seen an ape destroying a forest? My contention is that animal behavior is often a lot better than ours. When we commit evil, we commit evil on a mega scale. Isn't that true? No gorilla ever murdered 7 million other gorillas from a different tribe of gorillas. What gorilla ever did that? My contention is that the wickedness of human beings is far greater than any wickedness we see in the animal creation. Our lust of power has led to horrific wars. Our views on human identity, like the Nazi idea of the Aryan super race, have resulted in mass genocide, not only of Jews, but anyone who didn't fit into society or who was disabled. Mayo was responsible for over 60 million deaths during the Cultural Revolution. What animal has ever done that? We, of all primates, if that's how you would describe us, people made in God's image, are responsible for far more evil than any animal. The bestial past makes no sense to evil in the present. In fact, it would be better sometimes for us to revert to being animals, because whales and dolphins behave far better in community than we do. Far better. They don't kill each other. So I'm going to leave it there. And when I come again in 2 weeks, I'll carry on. Because we want to come right into the modern era, and I'm not going to rush that. But these are the forces. Can you see what's happening? Can you see the trajectory? Can you see the relevance? These ideas lead us into the modern world. And when I talk again, we talk about what's happening today, and it will be bang up to date. Thank you.